Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell Tovey, I am shimmering.
Ooh, are you,
yes,
baby? Tell me why you're shimmering, baby.
I am shimmering because today's guest's paintings, in my eyes, they shimmer. They are just the most beautiful, fluid, shimmering kind of saturations of colour, which I did actually steal from Flowers Gallery. My friend Antonio works at the wonderful Flowers Gallery and invited us recently to see the exhibition of today's Talk Art guest, and both of us were blown away by the works that we saw. Immediately, I was struck by the kind of intimacy and the direct kind of self-portraiture, but not always. I mean, it is kind of figurative work, but often they make these paintings that are just kind of like moments from life, like, as well as kind of direct figurative portraiture. But I just love all the kind of floral elements of and the kind of personal symbolism that runs through this kind of like current throughout the work. And I love the fluidity of it. And there's actually an amazing quote from today's guest, which says, "Nothing is fixed, everything is in flux, and anything can change it." And I really feel that in the work. There's this kind of tension that, like, at any moment, something might be revealed. So we are very proud and very excited because we did actually finally meet for the first time at our Talk Art Book 2 launch in London. And it was such an honor to meet this artist. I was actually really overexcited.
Yeah, we were fanboys.
As I am right now. Yeah. Totally. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art the one and only Victoria Cantons. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Robert, Russell. Wow. Thank you. What an intro. My head is just bursting. Thank you.
And you've been at the studio since very early this morning, haven't you?
Well, early for me. my partner and I, partner Su Yang, Chinese artist that we met at college doing our BAs together. So we went to China and I got back last week. She got back from China 2 days ago. She was visiting her family, and we are trying to reset our clock so that we come into the studio a bit sooner in the day rather than starting late morning and finishing kind of late night, which was our practice before we went to China, kind of like starting 11-ish and normally working in the studio until 10 or 11 at night. I mean, to go on until 1 or 2 in the morning isn't necessarily that productive, because you think you're getting loads done at like 11, 12, 1 a.m. But then the next day, you're so zonked that you get very little done. So you kind of lose everything that you advanced the night before, even though sometimes, you know, you're in the zone with a painting or you're working on an area of a painting where it's like, I've got to do this before I go to bed. You know, this area has to be finished because I'm working like wet in wet, for example. And
What does wet in wet mean to people listening?
So wet in wet is when you're working with different colors and different brush marks, but it doesn't matter that all that material is all wet on the canvas. So it means that when you're making a brush mark, the marks will bleed into each other or mix into each other, as opposed to, say, painting an area and you want very clean edges and not mixing of colors. So you'll wait for that area to dry, maybe a few days, because it's oil and it's slow drying. And then you can carry on with the next area without there being any like color mix. It's easier if you're working with acrylic, well, in that regard, because acrylic will dry in about 20 odd minutes. And so you can have these kind of clean areas of color. You can achieve them more easily. If you want to have the kind of wet and wet experience with acrylic, you have to use mediums that actually slow down the paint drying process, extender mediums, and then you got paint that that will say maybe dry within an hour's time, and that will allow you a full wet and wet experience.
I love the idea of a wet and wet experience. It sounds pretty awesome, Victoria. But what? So the wet and wet experience, yeah, is
there. We go.
You
like technical art lessons?
Do you prefer a wetter wet experience than like a quick dry experience? What do you prefer?
It depends whether it's summer or winter. it depends on the work. You know, I've one of the things I've said before is that in other conversations with friends or whatever, or like a curator or gallerist, is that you know, the work ultimately is intuitive, it's emotionally led. You kind of like, when you're making a piece of work, it's a conversation anyhow. So sometimes the pathway you're going down is that the work demands, and the conversation I'm having with the work is such that it's got to be a clean piece. Like, I don't know, a lot of the transgender women paintings, those large scale self portraits that I was doing in 2021-22, those were done over a significant amount of time. Areas were drying, and then I was doing the next part. I know, eyes, for example, or lips. There's a lot of clean painting. And then alternatively, a painting that you saw in Flowers, for example, Subjective Ideas During Wartime, that painting, that's almost all wet and wet in entirety. But it's a very, you know, it's a painting that's kind of quick and direct, and you know, you're making decisions and responding to things in a very immediate, fast-paced way.
Mm. I was actually going to bring up that painting because that was the one when I walked into the exhibition that just blew my mind. And in a kind of dream art heist kind of state, that would be the one that I would steal. If I could afford it, I would have bought it. But yeah, I absolutely love it. And I just think it's a giant painting. It's like 2 meters by 1.7 meters, so 200 centimeters tall. And yeah, it's this beautiful painting of two lovers. And it's also got a kind of bed and a whole bedroom scene with the wallpaper.
You love
this
a bed,
beautiful,
don't you,
I love beds in art. Yeah, it's like my thing. And also it's got this beautiful portrait hanging on the wall of the couple, which I think is you and your partner.
Yes, it's actually an older painting. The painting that's on the wall in that is 2021.
Okay, so it's like referencing a painting that you'd already made.
Yeah, and a lot of what I do with my practice anyway, I'm constantly referencing back to older works, older series, and art history. It's part of what goes on with the work I make.
Kind of referencing yourself. I really like that.
Yeah, referencing myself and referencing also like artworks from history that I have a particular affinity towards.
Can I go back to then China and coming back from China and changing your time zone for what you spend in the studio? Why did you set that as the benchmark of coming back and you're going to change the way that you set your hours and your work hours?
Well, it was something that we were talking about because, you know, my partner and I, we work together, we live together as well. So the pattern is very enmeshed. we've both been complaining that kind of we come into the studio too late, we leave too late, and we don't think it's necessarily healthy. So this seemed like a perfect fit because there's the new adjustment of changing from 7-8 hours ahead.
Are you like, are you confident you're going to stick to it?
Well, it's been good the last couple of days.
we're 2 days in. Okay.
It's like the live work balance thing. It's always hard to. I think when you're a creative, it's really hard, that blurring. I even find it running the gallery because your friends, your kind of partners, like everything can merge, and then your working life actually feels like you're working with friends. So it's this big kind of blur. I mean, literally, I'm working with Russell, who's my best friend. So it's a funny thing, isn't it, in art?
Hmm. Yeah. No. Absolutely. And I think one of the things when I went to art school really late. I was in my early 40s at the point went to art school, and I was thinking through the process that this was an opportunity to create for myself a circle of friends that I would hopefully have for the rest of my life, who were all kind of into the same stuff I was, basically, and kind of, you know, we're on the same pathway together.
I love that. Yeah, I never went to drama school, and I always slightly envy people that have that year or the year above, the year below, and they do jobs and they have them sort of common denominators between each other. I was always envious of that. I can understand that. So if you did that in your 40s, prior to that, were you a practicing self-taught artist, or was you doing something
completely different? In effect, yes. Yeah. Because I mean, it's the old, I suppose, common story that, you know, as a kid I was always drawing. That's all I ever did. Covered my school books in drawings, drove my parents nuts with that. But they were unsupportive of me doing art. I mean, you know, they were both immigrants who had come to this country with suitcases and nothing else. And I suppose looking back on it, they thought that they wanted me to have like a stable kind of like job and career, you know, that put a roof over my head and gave me nice holidays and that sort of thing, because that's what they had worked towards themselves. And so this idea that I wanted to go to art school, because, you know, as a 16-17 year old, you know, I mean back then that was the mid 80s, so I was reading like Melody Maker and NME.
Oh cool.
Those old weekly music papers.
And they were like newspapers, weren't they? They were very specific.
Literally.
Because they were like printed out on newsprint and they were a big format. And that was my whole world as well in the early 90s, like my access to the indie art, not art scene, music scene. I used to love the physicality of them.
Absolutely. So I used to read those every week. And I remember reading about like bands, I don't know, Placebo meeting at art school, for example. And Rolling Stones met in like secondary school. I can't remember, but there are a number of bands.
Franz Ferdinand.
Pulp at St. Martin's.
And Edwin Collins and Orange Juice. I think maybe he was.
So it was like, there I was reading that as a 16-17 year old, and it's like suddenly, oh my goodness, there's such a place as an art school. That's where I want to go. You know, that suddenly I'm obsessed. And
well, Pulp famously sang about it as well. St. Martin's
of course,
College,
Common People.
In the really Common People. Yeah, I remember that being
amazing,
such a
fantastic song.
Yeah, because it was half piss take and half just fact. It was kind of genius, that song.
Oh, but the way that the song rises into this great crescendo,
it's a brilliant song.
You know, I still listen to Pulp regularly, and Jarvis, like the last solo album he did, that's a regular in the studio. That's such a great album. Yeah, so my parents were not at all supportive. And of course, I had a whole bunch of other issues because I'm transgender. And even back then, you know, ever since I was a kid, really, I'd been dealing with gender and identity issues. So, you know, I had no siblings. It was not to like, you know, want anyone to like play a violin, but it was a challenging house at times. to grow up in for various different reasons. And I wanted to do was really, I suppose, please my parents ultimately. And so when they said, no, you're not doing that, I didn't challenge it. And it wasn't until, this sounds absolutely horrific, but it wasn't until my father passed away, what was it, about 20 years ago, that I suddenly thought, oh, I can do art more seriously. And so I like rented a studio at that point, because before that I'd been painting in like the spare bedroom of my parents' house, because mum and dad said, well, you can make art on the weekend as a hobby, you know, yeah, focus on a proper job and make work in your spare time, if you like, because you enjoy to do that. But in the early 20s, I got a studio. And I suppose I'd had all this kind of no, drummed into my head about what I couldn't do. That it never occurred to me. Like, I mean, I was, 32 at the time? It never occurred to me at that point, oh, I could actually go to art school now. You know, dad isn't there to say no anymore, and I don't have to fight with him over that. So I just I found a studio and made friends within the art studio community. But it wasn't until after I had dealt with transition, like 10 years ago, when that had all been dealt with, my gender issues, that then I thought, okay, I've got no dependents, no one that I have to take care of, no one to say no to me. I'm going to do the thing that I want to do. And I am going to go to art school because that's what I wanted to do ever since I was a teenager.
And I sometimes feel like older artists, like if people start in any kind of creative discipline a bit older, sometimes they can sort of go in much more self-assured somehow because they've already got so much life experience and they've also got stuff to make work about.
Yeah, I think it's a double-edged sword because on one level there's the issue that you've got less time. You know, all my classmates were in their 20s when I was doing my BA and there I was like a 42-year-old. And I was like, you've got your whole life ahead of you, you know, to do whatever, to discover, to do adventures, to make mistakes, whatever. And like, you know, they were all like kind of we graduated and they were like, I'm gonna have some time off and then think about maybe doing an MA in the future. And I'm just like, hang on, where's the MA? I want that next. I want it now.
The thing is, though, like we interviewed the estate of Jean-Michel Basquiat a few days ago, his sisters, Liz Zahn and Jeanette, and they were talking about when Jean-Michel was in his 20s and he would often say to them like, oh, a lot of the people that he'd heard of either in music or art, I can't quite remember, but they all died young. And he seemed to have some kind of knowledge that perhaps he wouldn't live that, you know, into his older age, which obviously I think he died around 28, 27 or something.
27, and, I think, is that, 27, that magic.
Yeah.
That weird number.
Weird number, yeah. But therefore, he just dedicated so much, like every living hour, to making work. So in a way, sometimes, you know, even when you're young, you might not be there forever either. But I think people can still make huge contributions, even if you have, you know, less time, per se, than people who have like decades and decades, if you know what I mean. There's something about intensity and focus.
So like I was saying, double-edged sword, and the flip side of that is that it's what you were mentioning earlier. You come into school, into the studio, into this life-changing experience with a whole bunch of baggage to draw on. Pardon the pun. And and so it was like kind of I virtually skipped into school every single day. You know, I was like when I was doing my BA and even my MA, I would get to college and early in the morning, soon after the gates opened, and I'd be one of the last to leave the building when they were closing. And that was like literally every single day of the week.
Wow. I mean, I feel that in your painting, interestingly. I think that's what struck me about the show. There's a vitality and an urgency in the mark making, and actually a joy. And it kind of vibrates. And that word shimmering, you know, which I'd read in the Flowers Gallery text, there's this sense of it does vibrate. And it is this kind of excitement and vitality and life force, which I think is obviously partly the fact that you're now able to, you know, just run with being creative.
Well, live your dream, basically.
Yeah, and that kind of state of mind that's freedom, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, and a thank you. I suppose it's the old adage of your friend, who I'm a huge fan of, Tracy Emin, talks about how art saved her. And I can completely relate to that statement wholly. There is literally nothing else I feel I can do or want to do. And I'm in I feel as if I'm in an incredibly privileged position that I can, you know, work and make painting every day in the studio.
And have you found this group of like-minded friends that you wanted to go to art school to discover? Do you have like a crew that you can move around with?
Oh yeah, totally.
Oh, nice.
That's the other great joy. We are definitely a family, and you pick your family, you know. Of course, there's the family that you're born into, but ultimately the family that you have every day is the family that you choose to be a part of.
And your friends are the family you choose for yourself.
And I have a family, and that's another great blessing. Absolutely.
Oh, Victoria, this is amazing. This is so inspiring. So you referenced earlier, we were talking about the woman series, the transgender woman series. And actually, I've noticed that there's been like a strike through in some documentation of the transgender woman series, and other ones, it hasn't been struck through. But it's an amazing series. And I think it's numbered from 1 to 11. And for me, I find this the most generous artistic offering ever. And I feel like it's such incredible documentation for our community and for representing the trans experience. And also as an artist, I find it so compelling and historical, and I think it's a body of work that everybody should know about. And I would love to discuss more about this, but the thing that really I also love about it is that it's non-sequential, and we're looking at 11 stages of facial transformation, and it's non-chronological and it's non-sequential, but you obviously do follow a narrative. But it's so striking and arresting and, you know, upsetting at times, but I find it so important. Can we talk about that body of work? And do you feel that, and have you felt that from other people already?
Yeah, no, thank you. It felt like an important body of work, certainly by the time I'd got to like 8, 9, 10. You know, I mean, number one was just painted as was just a painting. You know, there wasn't any thoughts about a number two or three, etc. It was just like up until number one occurred. So I used to paint in a very abstract manner, and I suppose shifted during my MA towards figuration. And then even then, when I started actually painting like people, there were masks, there's armor, there was, or I simply painted other people. I used friends as models, for example. And eventually, late 2021, I guess, I think, when number one got painted.
And these are all self-portraits, by the way, for people listening. These are all you.
Yeah, they're painted from selfies over time. I think the oldest one so far is one from about is a photograph from about 15 years ago. So a long time before I had even started any sort of hormone therapy as a trans woman. So we were in the studio, Yang and I, and Yang was like, "Why are you always painting other people and other figures? You know, why don't you paint yourself?" So, you know, that whole series, it exists thanks to my partner. But I was like, okay, you know, I'm willing to, you know, take a punt on painting me. And so I took this large scale canvas, and I'd worked on that canvas size before. So it's a canvas size I was very happy with, 170 by 150. And it's like an 8x10. So like I used to do, like going all the way back to school days, I was big into photography. And one of the things with my work is that a lot of my canvases generally reference photographic print sizes. So like 8x10 or 6x7 in terms of their height versus width. And I looked at like a passport photo. I said, you know, I'm going to take the passport photo and blow it up. And so that's what became that first painting. And then when I went to title it, I just thought transgender woman, but I'm going to put a line through the word transgender, because, you know, this is a woman, and okay, it happens to be me, but that's not the most important thing. It's just, it's a woman, and okay, because it's me, she happens to be transgender too. But I want people to, I hope that the viewer can see beyond that and like just see the individual, because, you know, it's not like I ever went into a gallery or museum and saw someone that represents me up on the wall. And so I was hoping that maybe that's what this painting could be. And as soon as I finished it, it was like, okay, I can do another, because that was an interesting exercise. But what if I can explore the subject and the theme again, and how will that come out differently? How will that look? And so that became number two. And then that was the beginning of the ball rolling at that point.
You know, Victoria, that is so beautiful, what you just said. And it got me thinking about the word frank and also the word candid. And I've been thinking a lot about those words this week, because we went to the Hay Festival and we met Ruby Wax, the comedian and performer. And she's also an amazing best-selling author. And she's written this book all about her last year in a place where you go when you have a mental health crisis. And she wrote this beautiful book all about her struggles. And I loved the words frank and candid, because there's something so sort of direct and honest about, you know, that sort of mode of communication. For you, do you see your works as candid, and has it been like challenging, or is it difficult to allow yourself as an artist to be that direct? Because I know you before didn't necessarily make self-portraits. So what's that shift been like for you?
I think really, even though it's been progressive, you know, what I was saying earlier about how I was making, you know, paintings with armor in them, with masks in them, but ultimately there's also been a progressive, like, dropping down of all those barriers and those shields. And I think to a degree it began with, I guess it began with transition, because you know, and I was going through literally when I first went to a doctor about advice for transition, the doctor said, you know, you really should see a therapist. And so I embarked on therapy, and I saw a therapist right up until I started art school. So I had about 3-4 years of therapy before that, where I was seeing a therapist weekly, and certainly about 3 years where I was seeing a therapist twice a week. So that was really, really super intense. And there was a lot of peeling away the layers of an onion, basically. And in that process, what I learned was also with the art, the only way that it can really work is to be honest and fully revealing. At least that's the only way it can work for me. If I'm not putting it all there on the table, then how can I expect someone else to come to the work and engage fully? Because they're not engaging with a totally honest statement, if you like.
So, is that honesty incredibly vulnerable for you, or is it an empowering position to work from?
I think initially it was probably scary and a vulnerable thing, but progressively it's become empowering because ultimately, you know, as I've said in other work of mine, truth will set you free. And I used to have a friend who said, you know, truth is truth, and if it's, you know, if you can't examine it from every angle, then it wasn't truth in the first place. It's got to be. I know. I guess I'm an all or nothing person, perhaps as simply the person I am, and that's the way I function, and I don't feel comfortable with it being any other way. That doesn't mean to say that another person, you know, who I'm being face to face with, has to be that way with me too. Of course, it's their choice, but it's the only way that I can be.
And this series is 1 to 11. And do you see it as, you said it was kind of happening one after the other, but do you see it as a full body of work, or are they separate works? And are we seeing the end? Is it 1 to 11, or is this something you think you might continue throughout your career?
I would like to think I'll come back to it, though at what point, I don't know. You know, I have other ideas about other questions that I want to explore through my work, and I'm very much engaged in those right now. So when I'll come back to it, I don't know. But I just recently, the last two shows I've had in Guts Gallery and in Tube Culture Hall in Milan, they both have works in them that are referencing past paintings from 3-4 years ago. So series is, you know, stop and start and then kind of like re-begin again.
I love that. Well, for me, I feel like this is a really important body of work that needs to be seen in more exhibitions as a piece. I feel like it's really just this record of trauma and healing. I find it incredibly empowering.
I mean, it would be wonderful if it could be like seen in other places. I mean, I've had some wonderful experiences through the work. You know, it's like I've been in a flowers gallery in the show that you went to see, an October Flush, the big facial surgery close-up painting that's facing subjective ideas. The bed painting, you like that one? At the PV, a gentleman came up to me and he was like, you know, thank you so much for that painting. My son is transitioning from female to male, and I found that painting really moving. I've had encounters when the transgender women paintings were exhibited at Flowers Gallery in 2022. I had trans women come up to me or contact me through Instagram, like wanting to talk about those paintings and about their own experience as women who happen to be transgender. And, you know, the fact that's happening for me is the value in the paintings. Mm. You know, it's like whether they are in someone's collection, whether they're in a museum, ultimately that doesn't matter. They've had connection with another individual where it generated a response that was a positive engagement. I guess, you know, as an artist, you can't ask for more than that.
That's beautiful. You know, you mentioned Milan, and you've got a show there currently, as well as the incredible extra show in London, because you've had like back-to-back shows in London with Guts Gallery. The show there is called What Birds Plunge Through Is Not the Intimate Space. But Italy, let's start with that one. I know that the flower kind of series, like the floral motif that I mentioned in the intro of roses, the body of work that we saw at Flowers Gallery was made in Italy, no? So can you speak a bit about the importance of Italy and the light there and all of that?
Yeah, so the pieces that you saw in Flowers Gallery, in Nothing Is Absolute, in that show. So flowers... as a motif began for me, I think 2017, I think. And the very first floral painting was in September 2017, An Act of Rehearsal is the title of that painting. And it was just after I had buried my mother. So my mother died after she had Alzheimer's. And she had a long, slow deterioration, unfortunately, for her, and for all of us that were close to her, because it's not a pleasant thing. But I suppose there was a part of me that was inspired by the fact that she was a very keen gardener, and she hated cut flowers, and I suppose this was all on my mind when I was painting in September. And so flowers started appearing in the paintings at that point. And initially as I started painting them, they became very romantic, and they became very romanticized. You know, with you know, paintings such as All the Words I Cannot Say and From the Cradle to the Grave. Those paintings, which are literally almost like a bunch of flowers in close up. And one of the things that I was thinking about at that particular point in time was how flowers are with us our entire lives. You know, your mother's in the hospital, she's just had you, and what does everyone do? You know, congratulations, here's some flowers. You go to prom, and it's, here, have a flower, corsage. You get a new job, you get a new home, congratulations, flowers. You do well in the school play or a performance, flowers. You go on a date, declaration of love, I love you, flowers. You have an argument, you want to make up, and you're apologizing, flowers.
It's like the David Trigley print that says sorry for being awful with a big red flower. Yeah.
Yeah, you get sick, get well soon, flowers. Change your job, flowers. Fight all the way until, you know, funeral, flowers. They're there all the way through. And I thought that was really interesting. And so the early flower paintings of like 17 and 2018, they were very much kind of around these ideas, and kind of, as I said, I was kind of romanticizing it a lot. But as they progressed, another thing that materialized was also, as I said, my mum hated cut flowers. So she was a keen gardener. We had loads of flowers in the back garden at home, which she tended to with care. And they're very seasonal. So I decided that I would paint a series of floral motif paintings annually, seasonally, and they would be a response to where I was at that point in my life at that time, I guess. And so that's what I've been doing since then, and what they have currently materialized into is like vanitas paintings.
What's that? So, what's vanitas painting?
Vanitas, we're talking about Dutch Golden Age, late 16th century, 17th century. And, you know, the Dutch Empire was incredibly powerful, perhaps the most powerful empire in the world at that point in time, the way it stretched all the way across to Asia from Europe and throughout Africa as well.
And Latin America, yeah.
And so, you know, there was extreme wealth in Holland. And so what do the art collectors do? They start getting paintings. I don't know, maybe it was through commission. And the artists also responding to all of this by making paintings that are basically saying, you know, you have all this wealth, you have all this materiality, but ultimately the only thing that's important and the only thing that you will have at the very end is your life and your relationship with God. You know, we come into the world naked. We're going to go out as just, you know, a rotting corpse. And
with flowers, but yeah.
Yeah, with flowers, of course.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And I suppose the paintings. So when I went out to Italy last year, I did a residency in Umbria, just on the outskirts of Perugia, which is really beautiful. But like when I was out there, it's kind of like you come out the house. I came out the house each morning, looked around me, and it literally could have been a thousand. It could have been 1,000 years ago. There is there's not a flight path, so you've got no planes to like in the sky, and the where the residency was, the surrounding land was on like a little hilltop, but the surrounding land is all just olive groves. You would have no idea. I had no idea I was in the 20th century or 21st century even. And I was reading a lot of Rilke, German romantic poet, and also Catullus. I've been reading Homer and Keats at that particular point in time. And there's a wonderful poem from Catullus, Roman period poet. He has to travel to his brother's funeral, and after he attends and he leaves there, and you know he's never coming back to that land because his brother's dead now, so that's the last time he's basically visiting, and he's leaving now to go back home. And he writes, "Say goodbye, Catullus, to the shores of Asia Minor," as he's traveling back to Italy from, like, I think it's a bit more eastward, so you're talking towards Greece. And there I was in the middle of Umbria. And so I just thought, I'm not going to have this moment again. You know, the residency is going to finish. I'm going to return to London, and that's it. It's done. And the thought that came to me was, you know, say goodbye to the hills of the Roman Republic, because out there, that's what it felt like. It might as well have been Rome or the Roman Republic, because there was such a little sense of today's world having touched that space. And so I embarked on the residency on what was in effect last year's series of floral motif paintings, which are all these, which are all looking at, I suppose, looking back over one's shoulder in a sense. You know, the titles of the pieces are along the lines of the things of experience fall away, and a moment perpetually of the past and the present. Let us keep each other company that we do not disappear into yesterday, or the blissful clouds of summer indolence.
Are these poem titles, or are these titles that you've come up with? And titles seem very important for your work. Yes, there are a lot of untitled, but when they are titled, it's really poetic.
I know, the language is so precise.
Yeah, so titles come about through maybe a reference to something I've seen or read or heard, you know, if I'm listening to the radio or a podcast or reading a book or watching a film or listening to a song. And they are also from my own poetry. You know, I am still regularly writing poetry, and I'm regularly writing notes and keeping a loose diary, so to speak, in parallel to my actual sketchbook and drawings. And so I pull the titles for paintings and other works in general out of all this, like, notes, my scrapbook of notes. But generally works get titled after they've been made. Have the title and
right.
Yeah, title follows artwork rather than the other way around. But I will also, you know, as one gets titled, just as artworks are referencing and following each other and looking back to each, I'm looking back to what I did before in terms of a new work being a response to a question and exploration I've already had. So titles can also do that too, so that you get a title like for a small painting from Italy. Suppose the light was the same under my sky as it is under yours. And the next painting was titled How the Dizziness Slips Away Like a Wisp of Cloud on the Wind. You know, that, and you know, I remember being on the patio of the property where the residency was, and just, you know, sitting out there with a cup of tea, and it was a azure blue sky, and there was a tiny little cloud, and I was just watching it, and I know what, 5 minutes, and it had disappeared, it had evaporated, it gone, or like the painting, which is a girl kind of looking in a very thoughtful manner, which was in flowers, happens to be that Yang modeled for that. And the title for that is, We Need to Watch It Over and Over Again for the Light That Is There. And it's a, you know, it's a completely different painting to the painting that is next to it hanging in the gallery, A Moment Perpetually of the Past and the Present, which is the white rose and the yellow background.
Yeah, I love that.
But to me, they're exploring exactly the same thing, because this idea of kind of reflection, exploring what it is to reflect on what's going on with me, you know, any given day of the week. That's what the paintings are about. They're explorations. They're questions. They're observations. They're reflections.
It sounds like the residency gave you a real slowing down, the fact that you had the time to sit there and watch a cloud evaporate to kind of go to say, we want to remember this, and we want to go back and remember this and keep repeating this. It feels like it's a real positive thing for you, because there is a certain energy, especially in the flowers, where they feel, with the drips, you see a lot of drips in them. It feels very action painting, feels very immediate. But if you're saying the musing going into it is actually quite reflective and slow, and then there's quite a conceptual energy that's going into them in some ways.
I mean, I don't think I am a particularly slow painter. But what does happen a lot in my process is that there is a lot of slow thinking, and then the activity of painting, you know, picking up a brush, making a mark, that can be very quick. But in between those moments, there can be a very long time of just thinking and reflecting. Because as I said earlier, it's a conversation between the artist and the canvas when a painter is making a painting. I really do believe that, and I'm sure you've had other painters that you've spoken to before say the same thing. You know, you kind of I come into the studio, and you know, speaking for myself rather than generalizing and trying to put words into the mouth of someone else who isn't here to defend themselves and say otherwise. I come into the studio and I may have an idea about a painting, you know, that I'm going to paint a particular thing and this is what it's going to be. And then the moment I embark on the work, I realize that the painting is like, no, actually, Victoria, I'm not going to be what you think I am. I am this. And it becomes this conversation and this also an adventure of problem solving. I remember having a conversation with Yang, or with one of my fellow painters in the studio complex here, and saying, you know, as painters, we're just problem solvers, because the moment that you start making the moment that you start making a work, you realize there's so many other issues to deal with. Forms next to each other, how the space, colors, marks, where one thing is meeting up against another, and it becomes so much more than the question that you had at the very beginning when you started off.
Yeah, it moves, doesn't it? Obviously, you are constantly, it's a battle, some people have described it as. It's a wrangling, whatever this idea is, or what the paint
is. Oh, yeah,
totally.
It can be.
Do you look at other artists? Because, you know, at the core of your practice, it's about human condition, gender, and social identity. Are there other artists that you've looked at that have given you inspiration or the courage to make uncompromising work?
Oh God, far too many to list. you know, I know where I remember that that question was being asked when I had done the People Trust People Who Look Like Them exhibition last year in
Flowers.
That's
such an incredible title. It's such a sad truth to that.
So in regards to that title, that came out of a conversation with the surgeon who did my feminizing facial surgery. Because what people may not realize with transitioning from male to female is that the estrogen and the removal of testosterone from the equation, it does invoke a lot of transformations in the human body. Testosterone is a cell-building hormone. So when you are a male-bodied person, you get lost in the terminology these days because you're not wanting to offend anyone, cis, trans, and so on and so forth. But
that's interesting. Do you find it hard then as a trans woman? Do you still feel like you have to tread carefully sometimes when talking about pronouns and gender? Is this something?
Well, I think the terms have expanded more and more, and then of course, you know, even as I was going, you know, I initially went to the GP early 2009, so that's when I began my official transition journey, so to speak. And at that point, I had a particular understanding of myself, and there were pronouns and terminology I was using to talk about myself as a trans woman. And that evolved over time. And the way I talk about myself as a woman that happens to be trans today is not the same way I spoke about myself, you know, 13, 14 years ago, or even 5 years ago, say. But anyway, going back to testosterone, it builds cells. It's like, to use an analogy, it's like a coral reef builder. So testosterone thickens individual hair follicles. It thickens skin. It builds muscle tissue, and it strengthens and builds bone tissue, especially around the face. You know, the brow of a male is more pronounced than of a cis female. The jawbone, you know, you talk about the classic square jaw of a alpha male. That is down to, again, that is down to testosterone and what it's doing for the cells in your body. And of course, you know, I didn't have hormone blockers as a teenager, and I began my hormone treatment as a 39 year old at that particular point. So I'd had 30 odd years since I entered puberty, for argument's sake, a 9 year old, at 30 odd years of testosterone building my body, so to speak. And I had some of those transgender strike through women paintings show, I had a very masculine appearance. You know, as one person said to me at the time I transitioned, all you're going to look like is a truck driver in a dress. And I was like, fine, I'll accept that. You know, it's better than the experience I'm having right now, because I was ready to throw myself off the top of a car park. I was so depressed, and I was so self-destructive at that time, because I'd spent years living duality, where I had one social group that knew me in my male mask identity, and another social group that knew me in and referred to me as her, as she, as a female, and I'd been living that duality ever since I was a teenager, and I just couldn't hack it anymore. So it was like, you know, I can only do one reality, one existence now. I've got to see a doctor, and I don't care what the outcome is. I don't care what I look like at the end. I've read articles about trans women, read books. I've seen trans women in film, and it's like, and if I look as that person said to me, like a man in a dress, so be it. I've already been going around in a dress half my life anyway, as it happens. So why not just simply go around in a dress for the rest of my life from this point onwards? It's got to be better than doing this 50-50 life I've been embarking on. And so I started hormone treatment, and one of the things that came out in therapy was this idea that if I could change my appearance and reverse the effects of testosterone on my face, that masculinization of my face, would I undertake that? And how would that transform my life? Because every single day I just stepped out the front door of my home and went out into the street, and I was bearing in mind this is like we're talking about 2008, 2009 anyway, and, you know, London was a slightly different place to the way it is today. But at that point, I was getting, you know, remarks as I walked past the person on the street. Oh, you know, that's a man pretending to be a woman. I was filling up the car with petrol at the petrol station, and I had a guy filling up his car at the adjoining pump and say, hey, give us your number. Me and my girlfriend love people like you. You know, I was being fetishized. I was being objectified. I was being followed around shops. I remember one experience where I started off on Oxford Street in John Lewis, and I walked a few doors along Oxford Street into Debenhams, and then came out of Debenhams and walked further down Oxford Street into Selfridges. And all the way along, there were these two guys following me.
Oh, God.
And finally, I was just like, I turned to one of them because he wasn't that far away from me. I mean, he was like no more than about 10 feet away from me. And I said, excuse me, can I help you? I feel as if you've been maybe following me for a little bit. And then he just turned around sheepishly and walked off. I'd be in Sainsbury's. I'd be buying my groceries. And you know, it's not like I'm wearing stiletto heels and a miniskirt and fishnet stockings and a like boob tube top. And it's like, and so what if I am? What difference does it make if I am? But I wasn't. I was just wearing trainers, jeans and a t-shirt. Very innocuous appearance, so to speak. But it doesn't mean, but it wouldn't stop the next person in line saying, hey, what are you? Are you a man or a woman?
So or like, offensive and or, just intimidating. It must be such
yeah, a... Or like, you know, what are you doing? And that was happening to me many times each day, every single day. And I thought, you know, what if I... And of course, also, there's the fact that, you know, you get up in the morning, you go to the sink, wash your face, you look in the mirror, and I saw me, but it wasn't me. And it was like, you know, what if I can alter that? So I embarked on an exploration of finding a surgeon that could do feminizing facial surgery that specialized in that. And when I eventually met the surgeon who undertook that, like what he said to me is, you walk down the street and what we're all doing is making decisions subconsciously every millisecond about the people that we are walking past or walking towards. Like, say, you know, you're walking down the high street, for example. And he said, it's all based on the T section, the eyes, nose, mouth. He said, you know, we're looking at all these people around us and we're saying, are they risk or no risk? Are they friendly? Are they unfriendly? Should I fight or flee? And that's what we're doing every given moment.
And that's the title, People Trust People Who Look Like Them.
Yeah. And so that's where the title came from.
Wow.
From that, you know, he said, I'm going to feminize your appearance so that you effectively, you look in the mirror, you feel that you're looking at a reflection of your feminized self. And that's what other people are also going to see too. And so that's what happened. And it's very funny. Soon after that, and like, it's, you know, I look like I do in one of those paintings from the Woman series where all that bruising, and I'm in the supermarket and I had the person at the till, like waiting to pay, turn around and say to me, I hope he was arrested by the police, because she thought I'd just been beaten up by a guy, which was very sweet of her. But, you know, I mean, that was obviously not the truth of the matter. But, you know, but people's response to you is completely different. I went from having an experience where it was like, are you a man or a woman, to an experience where there was another woman presenting solidarity with me, so to speak. It's really crazy the way that the human psyche works. And I suppose, you know, the Strike Through Transgender Women series, it's in part exploring about that, and it's also something I've been exploring further in those smaller portraits, like the one that was in The Window of Flowers, A Way to Fight Your Demons and Dogmas, for example, and other small head paintings like that. But then, and I realise I've just been rambling and gone massive detail.
I just want to say thank you so much for your honesty. I mean, help people. You're going to help people with your art. You're just by the work you're making and the way that you're talking and people listening to this podcast, this is going to make a difference. Your work is making a difference. Your honesty is, your authenticity is so needed, and it's so important.
You know what else? It's like such an important thing to be able to hear your experience. Mm. And I'm really grateful for you for sharing that with us, because in a wider way as well, it's kind of like, you know, if you think of transphobia, like, it's connected to racism, it's connected to homophobia, it's connected to sexism, xenophobia, ableism, fatphobia, you know, misogyny, the whole thing is connected. And that's what I really taking strength from at the moment, is that these conversations are happening more and more. And thanks to people, even like our friends Natalie and Naomi, who run Everyday Racism, like, they're regularly posting about how interconnected all of these issues are, and how we need to be, you know, there
build
for each
solidarity.
Other. And, you know, Russell and I, exactly, to build solidarity. And Russell and I, as queer men, you know, gay men, like, it's a bigger picture now. You know, I feel like we're all more educated and more connected. And if you know, I'm just really grateful for your description.
I mean, I suppose the crazy thing for me is that we are still having to talk about issues as in, like, an us versus them.
We sit here, you sit there, manner. Sort of thing.
You know, it's like, and, you know, and you're seeing that in conflicts the world over, whether it's the war in Ukraine or even, I don't know, say the Middle East versus the West, or like in any given country, on any border, in any community, there is repeatedly this us versus them conflict going on. And it's like, why? How on earth do we move towards a situation where we understand that we're all in this together, and that we're all facing the same struggles and that with the same problems, and that ultimately, you know, we have more in common than we have more that's different? It just seems like, while there are elements of patches in humanity where there are people that are realizing that, there are still so many other patches where it feels like it's going to take generations to fix that.
You're right, there's more that unites us than divides us. And there's an amazing quote of yours, which I read in your statement, which I think is beautiful in some ways, is that gender is not important when one is painting. And the freedom that you're finding from painting, where you're able just to be genderless, be this vessel for creativity, I find incredibly beautiful.
Thank you. Wow. But yeah, absolutely. You know, why do we even have to focus on gender so much? Why is that such an important thing for some people? It baffles me.
Yeah. We love you, Victoria. Thank you. We're really going to get into our final questions now. This has just been a kind of...
I'm feeling really emotional. I'm almost
it's
crying.
It's really... We're having a really... It feels like a really important, needed conversation, and one that we haven't really gone in on like this on the podcast.
But, you know, you two are beautiful people, and for making this conversation happen, for creating this platform that we are able to have this conversation as we are having right now. You know, God, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, the first question we ask everyone, just to flip into this, is if you could do an art heist, you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, Lord. Oh, goodness, that is such a tricky one. It's like, I know you ask these questions at the end of every podcast.
Yeah, we do.
And still.
And still. He said you've listened.
You've listened.
I didn't know still, you were going to ask me that.
Still, I'm unprepared. I have favorite paintings, of course. The Flaying of Marseilles by Titian is a fabulous painting. I love 100 Years by Damien Hirst.
The
Cow and the Flies. I mean, that is a...
Describe that work, because I think that is an incredible work as well.
Glass vitrines, so like glass cabinets, and there is on one side, and they're large. They're like how big is this vitrine?
Like a family bathroom.
Like a child's bedroom.
Yeah,
kind of size. It's pretty big. And at one end, you've got a starts off at the beginning, a fresh cow's head.
A severed head, yeah.
Severed head in entirety. And then there is also a hatchery, I suppose, for flies, so that they can breed and produce eggs and hatch flies. And then also within the vitrine, you have one of those electric fly killers.
Insecticutor. Yeah.
Yeah, insecticutor. and so, the flies are using the cow head to aid breeding and their life cycle. But they are also being attracted to the electric insect device. Where they're going over there and dying in their hundreds, and it's this compact
ecosystem, really, isn't it? Yeah,
ecosystem, but also this kind of life cycle: eat, sleep, fart, die, repeat. it's the life cycle in a microcosm. And it's a really profound piece, which I've been lucky enough to see a couple of times in shows. And it's not a painting, and considering that I mainly paint, but I do love that piece.
Me too. And it's sealed, like it's all sealed. So you go up to it, and these flies aren't getting out, and you're able to watch this whole ecosystem. But actually, they found that flies have got out. They can't work out how or why. But sometimes at the end of exhibitions where this has been shown, there's flies within the actual space. So I don't know if they're showing solidarity for their fly friends trapped and they come from the outside. But a lot of them are able to get out somehow. It's like an impossibility.
Nothing is absolute.
Exactly, Victoria.
Yeah, okay. There we
and
go
also,
again.
Aside from Damien Hirst's best work, which it pretty much is, the Titian painting you mentioned is a really intense one, because that's like the skinning alive of a satire.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's... You know, I mean, he painted that really late in his life. He's loosened up a lot as a painter. I mean, I feel when I see that piece, when I've had the chance to see it, that here is a man who is painting in the sunset of his life, and it's like, I've got to get this down because I don't know if I'll be here tomorrow to continue it. That urgency, but at the same time, that it's another profound piece where you've got the satyr like being skinned alive, and
which is a character from Greek mythology for those who know, satyr.
Half man, half goat.
Horse, goat, yeah.
Goat, yeah. The back legs are like the.
That's my fetish. Yeah.
So the back legs are like a the rear end of a goat, and the back legs of a goat, and then the top half, the waist up, is human.
They also had really giant erections, didn't they?
All right, Rob.
Apparently.
They did. It's true. If you
Well, exactly. That's what I say, my type. So,
they used to like a good bacchanal as well.
They did. So, moving on from that, Titian and Hirst.
But also another favourite piece is the goldfinch, which is in I'm probably mispronouncing it terribly, but Mauritius, in Holland, the like private collection. It's in this same collection as Girl with a Pearl Earring. The goldfinch is like sitting on a perch, and it's tied to the perch by a chain around its ankle, so it can't escape. It can't fly away, and there's something in that which is unbelievably tragic, but it's also the way the bird is painted. The artist, whose name I can't recall right now,
Karel Fabritius.
Thank you. The way that he painted the bird, it's so economical. It's not overworked. It's just the right amount of brush marks, and yet it's a painting that's like so unfathomable. Beautiful piece, and I was really drawn to it, especially because of Donatart's book, The Goldfinch, which I don't know if you've read, but any listeners, I highly recommend it. I mean, there was a film, which I want to say I love the film, but film's all right. but the book is stupendous. You can read the whole book and you get to about the last 200 pages. And then you get this last 200 pages is this wonderful just monologue. Donatart just goes on one a bit like Ulysses, where it's this kind of like stream of consciousness about life, art, the world and everything, meaning of life. And in a way, you could almost skip the whole book and just go to that last 250 pages and read that, because that essay is absolutely jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Oh, good. Oh, and lovely tip.
Yeah.
And that painting as well, the eye of the bird is so intense. It's like deep soul, you know, connection to the eye.
Totally. So probably if I had to have one painting, it would be that one.
And the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
It's a tough call between blue and green.
Ah, I thought you were going to say red.
As soon as I said, so as soon as I said between blue and green, I thought, yeah, maybe red. I do love red. I do love red. It really pops.
Especially in your paintings.
Currently. If you're going by my paintings, I would say probably red, yeah. If you're going by what I wear, then my wardrobe is almost universally black. So I should say I love black, black as a colour.
Yeah.
But no, I do love green, especially a kind of like bottle green, emerald green. The mossy green just makes me melt.
Lovely.
What is the?
I also had emerald in my head, actually.
Sorry, I was going to say, what is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
I am going to quote one of my old tutors from back from BA days, and he said, we were sitting in front of my painting, and he said, Victoria, attack the canvas.
Yeah. Love. Never heard that one.
Attack the canvas. Think, like, look at Albert Olin. Yeah, like, He doesn't like hold back from attacking the canvas. Attack the canvas, Victoria.
And have you followed that advice? Is that something, that energy that you've pushed into your practice?
I think so. Yeah. I think you have to. I come into the studio and I'm ready with my sword and shield, and I am ready for it all, totally.
Oh. Well, we love you, Victoria. We are beyond ready for you and your work and your voice.
Thank you so much.
Everything. I mean, it's incredible. And I think anyone listening who's a curator who's looking for a series of works, I really think that the Transgender Woman series, the Woman series 1 to 11, should be touring internationally. I think it's incredibly important and brilliant and beautiful and moving.
Thank you very much. Yes. It's very kind of you.
And for those who aren't familiar with Victoria's work, you can visit Victoria's website, which is victoriacantons.com. And you can also follow Victoria on Instagram at Victoria Cantons. And the galleries we've mentioned today, Flowers Gallery, Guts Gallery, and also there's a group show at the Alma Pearl Gallery and Tube Culture Hall, and all kinds of shows happening. So yeah, you can get out there and start researching and learning more about the visual world of Victoria. Victoria, this has just been such an emotional dream, fantastic episode, and the reason we do the podcast. So thank you for everything you're doing, making, and thank you for you.
No, thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
We'll be back very soon.
Take care, everyone.
Lots of love.
Bye, Victoria.
Bye. Bye. Thanks, Victoria. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.